new domestically made destroyer and a minesweeper joined the Iranian Navy in a Persian Gulf port. Palestinians react to the election of Naftali Bennett as the new Israeli prime minister. They say Israel is a colonial entity, and their demands remain the same. A military base in the Iraqi capital Baghdad, which hosts U.S. troops, reportedly comes under a drone attack. I'm your host, Behrouz Najafi. It's good to have you with us. Iran has unveiled a new domestically made destroyer and a minesweeper in the southern port of Bandar Abbas. The destroyer, named Dena, is the latest of Moj-class frigates, fitted with different defensive and offensive systems. It's capable of sailing long distances in open waters. The warship has a flight deck for choppers and can detect, counter, or destroy aerial and marine threats. Iran also inducted the Shaheen mine countermeasure vessel into the Navy in the same ceremony. The full indigenous vessel uses the world's latest technologies to detect and neutralize sea mines. President Hassan Rouhani, who participated in the unveiling ceremony through a video conference, hailed the achievement that was made despite international pressures.
Today, we witnessed the unveiling of two warships. The vessels have been made over the past years, proving that no pressure, no war can make us surrender. We'll continue our path. The strength and capabilities of Iran's armed forces are for deterrence and defense. We never sought any offense against other countries, and we never will.
Rouhani said that the power of the Iranian military is used for supporting the country's neighbors, not to be used against them. The Iranian president also hailed the independence of the Iranian armed forces, their advanced capabilities, and the development projects in the past years. Tehran says negotiations on the revival of the 2015 nuclear deal have not yet reached their end, urging the U.S. to act and make a decision. Foreign Ministry spokesman Said Khatibzadeh said that legal and technical discussions continue in Vienna, and the ongoing session is unlikely to be the last round. He said it is too soon to talk about the results of the talks and that the remaining issues need political decisions to be made in the capitals of the negotiating sides. Khatibzadeh called on the U.S. to accept its mistake in withdrawing from the accord and make a decision. He also rejected the statement by leaders of G7 that claimed Iran's missile program is in violation of UN Security Council Resolution 2231. The spokesman said that the resolution has not put any restrictions on Iran's missile program, urging the G7 leaders to fulfill their failed commitments instead. When it comes to the acts of sabotage against Iran, especially its civilian nuclear program, it's been an open secret that Israel has been responsible, and that has included cyber attacks and assassination of scientists. But recently, the outgoing head of Israeli spy agency Mossad has revealed in so many words that Tel Aviv was behind recent attacks targeting Iran's nuclear program and the assassination of a top nuclear scientist, Mohsen Fakhrizadeh. This is the closest admission yet by Tel Aviv.
Since 2010, Israel has been linked to at least a dozen of attacks on Iran's nuclear program. These operations were aimed at disrupting Iran's progress in the field of peaceful nuclear technology through acts of sabotage targeting Iran's nuclear facilities and assassination of Iranian nuclear scientists. Between 2010 and 2012, four Iranian scientists, Masoud Ali Mohammadi, Majid Shahriari, Daryush Rezai Nejad, and Mohsen Ahmadi Roshan were assassinated, while another scientist named Fereydoun Abbasi was wounded in an attempted murder. Also, in November 2020, another top Iranian nuclear scientist, Mohsen Fakhrizadeh, was assassinated in a roadside attack. Iran blamed the killing on Israel and condemned it as terrorism. Tehran also slammed world bodies for their silence on the acts of terrorism targeting the Iranian nation and its elite personalities. Meanwhile, Tel Aviv neither confirmed nor denied its involvement in the attacks on Iran's nuclear facilities and scientists. However, last week, Israel's Channel 12 aired an eye-opening interview with former Mossad chief Yossi Cohen, who led the spy agency for more than 5 years. Yossi Cohen hinted at Tel Aviv's involvement in two explosions over the last year at Natanz nuclear facility, as well as the assassination of a prominent nuclear scientist, Mohsen Fakhrizadeh. He also shamelessly threatened Iranian scientists involved in the country's nuclear program with death. That's while Israel has always pursued a policy of deliberate ambiguity over its nuclear capabilities, as well as the issue of targeted killings and airstrikes. Iran's mission to the United Nations slammed Israeli lawlessness, saying that Cohen's comments reflect Tel Aviv's long-standing strategy of criminal sabotage against Tehran. Cohen's interview is aired as talks to revive Iran's nuclear deal are about to resume amid hints of progress. The Israeli regime has been the nuclear deal's strongest opponent, although the United Nations, the European Union, and others have hailed it as a diplomatic success.
Over the years, Israel has cried foul at Iran obtaining a nuclear bomb. No one can forget when the Israeli premier held a placard at the UN with a cartoon-like magic marker drawing of when Iran would obtain the bomb, which he falsely claimed would be in less than a year. Israel also made that false claim in the years 1992, 1995, and 2002.
Iran has repeatedly complained about Israel's attacks, with Iran's ambassador to the International Atomic Energy Agency, Kazem Gharibabadi, warning as recently as Thursday that the incidents not only will be responded to decisively, but also certainly leave no option for Iran but to reconsider its transparency measures and cooperation policy. Gharibabadi also slammed IAEA's silence in the face of terrorist attacks against Iran's nuclear facilities and the assassination of scientists. Israel has constantly accused the Islamic Republic of Iran of the weaponization of its peaceful nuclear program and assassinated several Iranian nuclear scientists in recent years. However, Iran has rejected all these accusations, as it was among the first nations to sign the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty. And it has been under the most intense scrutiny and inspection by the IAEA than any country in the world. That's while the Israeli regime itself has, under constant U.S. protection, avoided joining the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty and is now in possession of hundreds of nuclear warheads and other non-conventional weaponry.
Israel is saying that it claims a right to commit any act of murder or sabotage against Iran that it wishes. But what Israel doesn't realize, and what Israel's American backers don't realize, is that that these kinds of actions virtually force Iran or other such countries to take equivalent measures against Israel and the U.S. So they're opening up a Pandora's box by opening the international scene to all kinds of acts of murder, sabotage, revenge, etc. And every country will claim the right to do so, and they'll cite Israel as an example. So Israel is playing with fire here and is going to get burned because equivalent measures will be taken against it.
The revelation of outgoing Israel's spy agency that Israel was behind recent attacks on Iran's nuclear facilities and its top scientists shows that it has no respect for the law. That's while Israel has followed a deliberate policy of ambiguity for years. It seems favoritism towards Israel by the International Atomic Energy Agency, as well as Washington's invariable support for the regime, has given it the green light to break international law. Isn't it high time for the international community to hold Tel Aviv accountable for its crimes?
Now moving on, Palestinian officials have reacted to the election of Naftali Bennett as the new Israeli prime minister, emphasizing that a change won't affect their stance vis-a-vis Israel. Palestinian resistance movement Hamas says that regardless of the shape and color of the new administration, Israel remains a colonial and occupation entity. Hamas spokesman Fawzi Barhum said that Palestinians will resist by force to get their rights back. A spokesman for Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas also emphasized that its changes will not alter Palestine's position, which has always been a Palestinian state on the 1967 borders with Jerusalem al-Quds as its capital. Now, those reactions came after the Israeli parliament voted in favor of a new coalition cabinet, ending Netanyahu's 12-year tenure as prime minister. Now, right-wing Naftali Bennett will lead the new cabinet for 2 years before his centrist ally, Yair Lapid, takes over. In our news review program a short while ago, my colleague has discussed that issue with our guests.
Joining us is Gilad Atzmon, author and political analyst from the British capital of London, and we also have Mick Napier, political commentator from Edinburgh in Scotland. Gentlemen, welcome. Gilad, if I can start with you, every time a new Israeli PM takes over, we see more Palestinian killings, more settlement activity, more essentially Palestinian ethnic cleansing. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, I think that we have to accept that the vast majority of Knesset members are actually right of Netanyahu. And the new reality in this government is that they are totally dependent on the support of Arab parties, especially Mansour Abbas, the Israeli Islamic Party. The truth of the matter is that I don't see this government implementing very radical measurements against Palestinians, and I think that this is the reason that this government is not going to last for very long, because quite a few of its members are actually way far right of Netanyahu.
Right. Well, Mick, let's take a different angle. Naftali Bennett, I mean, some people have short memories. Naftali Bennett, was he not responsible for the massacre in Ghana, where over 100 Lebanese women and children were killed? And he's taken over from Netanyahu, who's just fresh from killing 66 children in the Gaza Strip.
The competition in Israeli politics is between Arab killers and those who wish to claim that they can kill even more Arabs. In a previous election against Netanyahu, the front runner at that time was Gantz, and he ran an election video showing photographs, showing videos of Arab, of Palestinian funerals in Gaza, with a body counter in the corner of the screen, and claiming that he had helped to drive Gaza back to the Stone Age. That was the centrist competition. I mean, it has to be in inverted commas, the so-called moderate competition for Netanyahu. Now we see the inbuilt tendency of Israeli settler colonialism, and it's the right versus the extreme right versus the more extreme right. Naftali Bennett famously said he said, "I have killed a lot of Arabs and I don't have a problem with that." So we have an open, boasting Arab killer who's the fresh prime minister. And you would think that Biden might have a problem with him. And of course, he will have a problem to some degree, but it's the problem of an indelicate prime minister who speaks the truth rather than tries to cover it up a little bit. We remember that Obama, even although he found Netanyahu politically very difficult, gave him a parting gift of $38 billion when he left office, showing that the political tensions were secondary to the overall strategic alliance between Washington and Tel Aviv. And it will be the same with Naftali Bennett. When Bennett opens his mouth, it'll be difficult for Biden and supposed liberals to defend Israel. But they will overcome that, because the strategic link is a very deep one. It's a very dangerous period for Palestinians. I don't think there's any room for complacency. Netanyahu was an Arab killer, but Bennett's trying to compete with that record. So we need to build the solidarity movement worldwide. The Palestinians face Israel, they face the UAE, Saudi Arabia, the USA, the EU. They have resisted to the limit of their ability. Now we need to find more examples of Italian dockers and South African dockers and California
right.
dockers who turned away Israeli ships. We need to build that solidarity movement. It's a very, very urgent moment.
Okay, an interesting conversation, I have to say. Thank you, gentlemen, for your... Let's thank our guests for their contribution. Gilad Atzmon, an author and political analyst, joining us out of London, and Mick Napier, a political commentator from Edinburgh.
Welcome back. Let's move on with the rest of this broadcast. A U.S. military base in the Iraqi capital has reportedly been targeted by an unmanned aerial vehicle early Monday. A security source saying that a drone hit Camp Victoria, hosting American troops at Baghdad International Airport. It caused no casualties, though. The target of the attack was runways of a military cargo aircraft. No claim of responsibility, but Camp Victoria had come under similar attacks in the past. The U.S. military logistics and diplomatic buildings have been increasingly targeted in recent months in Iraq amid growing anti-U.S. sentiments there. The Russian president says that he expects the upcoming summit with his U.S. counterpart to restore personal contacts and establish dialogue on issues of mutual interest.
It seems to me that the summit will help restore our contacts, relations, establish a direct dialogue, and create a functioning mechanism for action in those areas that are of mutual interest.
Vladimir Putin noted that Joe Biden shared his views about engaging in negotiations. He also said that Moscow would be ready for prisoner swap if Washington agrees. The two presidents are set to meet on June 16th in Geneva for a summit amid strained bilateral relations between the two on a wide array of issues. Washington says that Biden will bring up ransomware, cyber attacks reportedly emanating from Russia at the summit, which has been one of the most recent sources of tension between the two sides. That's a wrap for this news bulletin. Goodbye.
This is IRIB English Radio. Iranian news. Iranian culture. Iranian voice. www.parstoday.com/en. From the very heart of evergreen forests, under the starry sky of the desert, with the radiance of silver-colored sand, in the midst of proud mountains, close up, Iran.
Hello, I am Mitra, an Iranian nature traveler. To know more about the wonders and beauties of magnificent Iran, keep me company. This sound come from? Suppose it's a canary. This sound comes from the backyard. Oh, my neighbor, Miss Katayun, keeps some domestic canaries in her backyard, and this sound comes from there. They sing beautifully. Katayun is interested in nature, so she has put a lot of green plants in her backyard and has named this place as the Little Hyrkanian Forest. By the way, have you ever heard about Hyrkanian Forest? Today, we are going to Golestan province in order to get familiar with Hyrkanian Forest. Hyrkanian forests have remained from Cenozoic geology and Ice Age. These forests, which date back to 25 to 50 million years ago, are among the most valuable forests in the world. Hyrkanian forests stretch from Hyrkan region in the Azerbaijan Republic to Golestan province in Iran. These forests cover a total area of 2 million hectares in Iran, while the area of these forests in Azerbaijan is 20,000 hectares. 53% of these forests are in Mazandaran province, 26% in Gilan province, and 21% in Golestan province. Hyrkanian forests are among the most valuable forests in the world. In addition to supplying oxygen, these forests play a very important role in saving large amounts of water. These forests also enjoy a vast and diverse flora and fauna. Hyrkanian forests include 80 species of trees, 50 species of shrubs, as well as animals like panther, bear, goat, fox, etc. I am now in Golestan Forest, a very unique and spectacular forest in East Golestan province. This forest is a part of Hyrkanian Forest. It's interesting to know that these forests are famous as the living fossils. Walking in this forest is really exciting. Oh my god, this part of the forest has many, many beech trees. They are so tall and are grown densely, and actually I can hardly see the sky above. Oh well, I'd better not to raise my head so much. My neck is aching. Such a beautiful fox! Its head and tail are black, which specializes to this region. I'm very lucky to see a fox here. Oh, pity. It ran away as it realized that I'm here. Raspberry shrubs. Very, very delicious. I'd better pick some raspberries and give them to Miss Katayun as a souvenir from the real Hyrkanian Forest. Until next time, goodbye.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
The debate.
Hello, and welcome to another edition of The Debate. Thousands gathered in London on Saturday to call on G7 leaders to end their support for the Israeli regime. They demanded an end to what they called complicity in Israel's war crimes against Palestinians. In this edition of The Debate, we will scrutinize the role that developed countries are playing in the ongoing suffering of Palestinians and the pro-Palestinian protesters' demands.
As the G7 descended on Cornwall for the summit, thousands of passionate pro-Palestine protesters amassed outside Downing Street in central London on Saturday to vent their anger over ongoing Israeli crimes against the Palestinians.
These protesters are absolutely furious at the lack of action from world leaders following Israel's recent and relentless attacks on Gaza and the Al-Aqsa Mosque compound. Although a ceasefire has been agreed since then, the fact that Palestinians are still forced to live under an apartheid regime has bitterly fueled the anger of these protesters who want to force a change.
Protesters had various demands, including international recognition of the Palestinian state and an end to Israeli arms sales.
If arms are used in violation of international law, they must be banned, embargoed immediately. Also, the issue of settlement products, they must be banned immediately. Those are illegal products. The recognition of the state of Palestine is long overdue. We do not understand why the UK government is not even listening to the voices of its own people, the voices of its own parliament that voted overwhelmingly to recognize the state of Palestine. The lack of recognition is not only immoral, it is undemocratic.
Place an embargo on Israel. Stop the arms deal. So this is the message that we're sending to. The people are with us. We're in our thousands. And we are going to continue until, honestly, the Palestinians are free and occupation is ended.
We are not going to forget the mark of shame upon the history of this country that brought us to where we are today, the Balfour Declaration. We demand a public apology from the British government as well as recognition of our state of Palestine. On top of that, we want sanctions now. We want justice. We want action.
The bombs may have temporarily stopped falling, but while Israel's systematic discrimination against the Palestinian people continues, so will the protests. Robert Carter, London.
Now, to discuss that further, we're joined by Youssef Al-Halou, Palestinian journalist and political analyst, who is joining us from London, and also Mr. William Morris from the Next Century Foundation, the Secretary General, of course. Thank you very much for joining us, both of you. Let's begin with Youssef Al-Halou now. Labour lawmaker and former party leader Jeremy Corbyn addressed the crowd and stressed that industrial powers should end human rights abuses. What exactly did he mean by that?
Well, thank you for having me. Let's just assert that despite the fact that the ceasefire is still holding, it is fragile, that ceasefire did not end Israel's military occupation. And to put things into context, the Palestinian cause is gaining momentum. We saw those demonstrators in the British capital demanding the British government to impose embargo or stop arming Israel. Now, Jeremy Corbyn and other political figures, of course, they know clearly that Israel is enjoying a culture of impunity. When it comes to interests, we know that many countries around the world take Israel as a strategic ally. So we are not expecting the G7 leaders to really denounce Israel, because obviously Israel is as a proxy for those nations in the Middle East. And also, let me just remind the viewers that even the Palestinian mission in London, Mr. Hussam Zumrud, who just spoke in the report, he said that he believes that the UK believes that Israel is violating international law. So such statements from Corbyn or other officials, of course, reflects the hypocrisy of the international community when it comes to the Palestinian rights. Palestinians are being dealt with as subhumans, are being demonized because simply they are resisting the Israeli occupation.
Thank you very much. Let's bring in Mr. William Morris. In what ways do you believe that the G7 leaders are considered complicit in Israel's war crimes?
I don't even believe you're on the same planet as I am. I don't call them war crimes. I mean, unless you're talking about many governments in the Middle East having committed war crimes. No, I mean, the G7 leaders met to consider China, climate change, and COVID. Israel was not on their agenda, but the Palestinian
Of course, Mr. Morris, this was what the protesters were demanding. We're talking about the protests outside the summit, not what was happening inside the meeting.
Okay, well, there were big issues that occupied their time that they met to discuss. Now, Israel and Palestine has actually is back on the agenda internationally in a major way, and this is actually a consequence of this little war that's gone on. So there is a real opportunity for Middle East peace, and if nations in the region, including Iran, and nations internationally, including the United States of America, tried to really support moves towards a Middle East peace, we might get somewhere this time around. It's very encouraging that we have a new government in Israel. I mean, it's not the kind of government that is perfection, not by a mile, but it's a bit of fresh air. So we have an opportunity. We have an opportunity to build a peace instead of ongoing hatred, and that is opportunity that should not be lost at this moment.
So, Mr. Morris, how do you believe peace can be achieved as long as Israel is not respecting international law and its international obligations? I'm referring to the settlement buildings in particular.
International law has never been respected by anybody unless it's convenient to the great powers, Russia or America or whoever. I mean, you know, under international law, Jerusalem should be a state, as you know, a corpus separatum. It should be an international city. International law is utterly meaningless, but what matters is what people care about and what can be done to make for fair play and a way forward. And there's a real opportunity for peace now. It's interesting, Biden, who is a Zionist, but then all of us in the West are Zionists because we all believe in an Israeli state.
Let's bring in Mr. Yusuf Al-Halou.
Yes, about the future.
Thank you very much, Mr. Morris. Let's bring in Yusuf Al-Halou. Now, Mr. Halou, what do you have to say in response to Mr. Morris? He says that, first of all, there were no war crimes committed there, not more than anywhere else in the world, and also international law is not respected by anyone, and that's a good excuse for Israel not to respect international law as well.
Well, even Israeli, figures, they say that Israel is an apartheid state. Israel is even worse than apartheid state. And we know that Israel is annoyed from the BDS campaign. That's why it has allocated millions of pounds or dollars to combat those activists who are calling for disarming Israel or sanctioning Israel. Ironically, Israel is being viewed as the only democracy in the Middle East. And Israel is allowed to arm itself to the teeth with military equipment from the United States. And Israel has been using Gaza as a testing ground for its weapons. So Israel is a strategic ally, as I said, to those nations, because obviously there is intelligence collaboration, and Israel is dominating the Western agenda when it comes to self-defense, as if Israel is only allowed to defend itself from those Palestinian, homemade rockets or resistance activities, whereas Palestinians who have been subjected to military brutal occupation since 1948, they have no right whatsoever to defend themselves. So obviously crimes were committed, atrocities, ethnic cleansing is still ongoing since 1948. So obviously everybody knows that Israel has violated the numerous UN resolutions. Israel, considers itself above the international law. It's a rogue state. It has never respected any regulation or convention or international UN Security Council resolution.
Mr. Al-Halu, Mr. Morris believes that now, with a new Israeli government, of course, that is if they win the vote of confidence from the Knesset, with a new Israeli government, there will be hope for peace. How optimistic are you?
We are not optimistic at all, because we know that the Israeli government or Israeli successive governments, they use Palestinian blood as a winning card. We know the settlers, they are allowed to behave in this provocative manners, attacking Palestinians, confiscating Palestinian lands in Sheikh Jarrah or elsewhere. So we do not pin high hopes on any government, because we know from previous experiences that Israel is not interested in peace, and this is crystal clear.
Thank you very much. Mr. Morris, you heard Ms. Al-Halu. He says that Israel is basically not interested in peace, and the settlement buildings also confirm that. So why do you think a new government in Israel, which of course we do know the right wing still has the most power, and those are the ones that insist on the settlement buildings, why do you think there's room for peace?
Much of your rhetoric, and I'm sorry, it's based on hatred. And if you go on about apartheid state and hate, you're not going to build a climate for peace. And if you are no hopers that regard the situation as being hopeless, then you may as well crawl into a hole and forget it. I mean, people have to work for peace. And there is a real need, both on the Palestinian side as well as on the Israeli side, for new government and for a new approach. Abu Mazen has lost the plot. I mean, he scarcely has any credibility. Hamas say they won't. It's very convenient for them that they don't have to negotiate with Israel, because they can say Israel won't negotiate with them. It's all very childish, but we have a situation in which the Palestinians have given Israel a wake-up call, and nobody can take the Palestinians for granted anymore. So it is time and opportunity to build peace now, and to build on this current situation, and to find a better way forward. And the international powers can help in this, and not just the United States of America, but Russia, Britain, and the others. And I think there is a genuine mood, to do something. It does require help from the Palestinians, and it requires help from countries like Iran. I mean, Iran arguably provided weapons to Gaza. I don't know, you know better than I would. But, Iran is a player in this game. I don't think we'd have peace in the Middle East unless Iran is interested in helping build peace in the Middle East. But it's an opportunity.
Well, Iran's position has always been very clear, Mr. Morris. They want what the people of Palestine want. Iran has always been a supporter of Palestinian people, and Iran has always called for a referendum to decide what should happen in Israel. Now, let's go back to our topic, which was the protest. Mr. Morris, what was the demands of this Resist G7 coalition? What were they trying to achieve, and do you believe that they got close to their goals or not?
I think it's important that there were protests because it does help raise, there are protests on many things, as you know, at this moment, not just on Israel and Palestine, but there are many, many protests around the G7 on a whole range of issues. The most predominant one was on climate change, but nonetheless, it does help having this kind of, this raised awareness of the situation in Israel and Palestine. And so protests matter hugely in the West. They make a great difference. As to the rhetoric we hear, I mean, much of it is pretty extreme and unhelpful, but that's not the point. The point is that the issue is back on the table. Peace is back on the table. We have an opportunity. And you refer to settlement building. One of Abu Mazen's sins has been to halt peace negotiations as long as settlement building continues. Makes a very easy excuse for people, right-wingers like Benjamin Netanyahu, who can rub his hands in glee. I mean, something Arafat would never have done. He can rub his hands in glee and sit back and say, okay, so they won't talk to us, so we won't talk to them. But fortunately, we have the chance of a new government in Israel. We just need the same in Palestine, and we might move forward.
Thank you very much. Mr. Al-Halu, what is your response to Mr. Morris? Do you believe that there is a chance for peace with a new government in Palestine?
Well, we Palestinians, we are peace-loving people. Well, we hope so. There will always be hope. But we know that according to Oslo Accords, by the year 2000, Palestinians should have had their own Palestinian state, and Israel destroyed the Palestinian cause since the provocative visit of Sharon at the time in the year 2000. We are fed up from this occupation. Enough is enough. And Netanyahu himself, he repeated many times saying that the land is too small to be shared. So it's obvious that Israel is not interested to have a Palestinian state not next to its. And by the way, let's just make it clear, Israel has no recognized border. Israel has no constitution. So what peace we are talking about? Gaza, West Bank, East Jerusalem is less than 20% of historic Palestine. So even if this viable Palestinian state was agreed to be established, then it will be demilitarized. Palestinians are really eager to see peace prevail in the Middle East. So, but unfortunately, that we are being let down. We don't have high hopes when it comes to assuring Palestinians, oh, you have to adopt the nonviolent resistance, the peaceful methods. We tried everything. And by the way, President Abbas is Israel's best Palestinian leader at the time, because obviously it's not a hidden fact that the Palestinian Authority has made many concessions, whether it's during Arafat era or Abbas era. So any Palestinian leader, obviously the Palestinian side is the weakest side. Let's agree on that. Israel is the one who's dictating these rules, because the Palestinian Authority is receiving the financial support from donor countries. So Palestinians, they have no sovereignty. So at the end of the day, let's hope that the new government in Israel will strike deal with the Palestinians. But we don't have high hopes, to be honest.
Now, Mr. Al-Halu, Mr. Morris also mentioned that the voices of Palestinians are now being heard. Do you believe so?
I think the new generation is making a huge impact and effect. We saw the activists in Sheikh Jarrah. We saw new faces on the ground. The Palestinian cause is back to the forefront. What happened recently in those neighborhoods in Jerusalem, or the aggression on Gaza, has sent shockwaves. It's an awakening, because the world also is fed up. The world is annoyed from the fact that Israel continues year after year, day after day, with the occupation, atrocities, killing, imprisonment, confiscation of lands, and so on. The list is too long. So let's just put things into context. Israel can end the occupation now if it wants to, but it doesn't want that because it enjoys the control of other people, the Palestinians.
Thank you very much. Mr. Morris, now you heard what Mr. Al-Halu said. On the other hand, you seem to be very optimistic. So if you could please tell us about this demonstration, and you did also mention that their voices are heard and now they can make an impact. Do you believe that these G7 leaders will take any steps in order to get closer to the goal that you mentioned, peace?
Oh, 100%. I think it's a priority for Biden, less so perhaps for the others. But Biden has sort of begun to indicate that he really does care about this issue. Now, I did say he was a Zionist, but he has done some interesting little things. He's reopened the U.S., well, what was it, a consulate, but basically the U.S. offices in East Jerusalem, which haven't been there for, what, 20 years, 30 years? I mean, I can't remember them being open. So he's beginning to make a kind of a move, and I'm very encouraged. I think that there is a care about the man. He does care about the Israel-Palestine situation, and he wants a viable Israeli state as well as a viable Palestinian state. He's a two-state man, whatever his sins. So, you know, I think, and he'd be better with regard to Iran. He's compared to Donald Trump, he's a breath of fresh air. I would like to see a new leader on the Palestinian side, someone like Marwan Barghouti, who could actually negotiate peace but isn't actually asleep all the time. But that said, it is an opportunity, and we do have a chance for a better tomorrow now.
So, Mr. Morris, protesters were also predominantly talking about BDS, the boycott, divestment, and sanctions movement, to force Israel to respect Palestinian rights. Do you think this has played a role in pushing Israel towards moving towards peace?
You're an Iranian, and you support sanctions. You know what they've done to Iran. Sanctions are always wrong, always wrong. I mean, okay, arguably against apartheid South Africa. But since that day, they've never been effective. All they've done is punished ordinary people, punished ordinary Iranians or ordinary Syrians. Look at Syria under sanctions. I mean, you know, it's and the BDS, I mean, boycott. Well, fortunately, in my view, it's not made that much of an impression. But what has made an impression is these protests. They do matter. And if you want, the biggest thing in the United Kingdom, where I'm living, has been the Balfour Initiative. I don't know whether you've come across it, but that was very powerful, an activist campaign for a Palestinian state, which was very respected and brought Corbyn on board and his team. So, I mean, we have an opportunity. Actually, there is a Palestinian state. There is a Palestinian state. Let's just make this clear. And the campaign for greater recognition is an important one, as Mr. Halu mentioned. It's a very important one. It's gaining momentum, and I think that matters a great deal.
So, Mr. Al-Halu, what is your opinion regarding the BDS movement?
Well, solidarity is as important as the BDS campaign. Well, this is what Palestinians are adopting. They say that the BDS is effective, and this can be seen from Israel's reaction by fighting those activists worldwide, by classifying those BDS activists as anti-Semite. We know that Israel is also annoyed from the growing solidarity when it comes to celebrities. We've seen the angry reaction from Israeli officials towards those celebrities, you know, Ms. Hadid and the other ones. So this is what the Palestinians are left with. You know, the Palestinians have tried everything, and they hope that by following the footsteps of the South African experience, this might mount pressure on Israel. What they can do, Israel has got you know, the powerful army in the region, whereas Palestinians, when they throw stones, they are described as terrorists. So we have a double standard policy here. Palestinians, they will try everything possible on the table just to make their voices heard.
Thank you very much, Mr. Youssef Al-Halu, Palestinian journalist and political analyst, joining us from London, and also Mr. William Morris, the Next Century Foundation Secretary General. Thank you very much to both of you gentlemen for joining us on this edition of The Debate.
This is IRIB English Radio.
please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
لا إله إلا الله لا إله إلا الله.
Answering the doubts and questions and questions and answers on Islamic beliefs.
الله هو الرحمن الله هو المنان.
لا إله إلا.
Please send us your emails through our email, which is englishradio@irib.ir.
Assalamu alaikum. This is your host Haider al-Bahadli from Q&A on Islamic Beliefs, broadcasting from IRIB English Radio. Today we have our guest, Sheikh Murtada Karimi. Sheikhna al-Aziz, salamun alaikum wa rahmatullah.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah, and thank you for having me.
Sheikh, it's a pleasure to have you here. We were talking about a very interesting subject last time about the hijab of men and women, and we got caught up by the time of the program, and we really wish to hear the rest of your arguments and points. So please continue where we were last.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. So a part of the question was that as ladies, we want to, I mean, why Islam is imposing hijab on us, the ladies. Rather, Islam could ask the men not to look at non-practicing hijab women. We mentioned that, first of all, the ruling of hijab is for both men and women. And second of all, Islam has asked both men and women to lower their gaze when it comes to illegal scenes and looks. Let me just share one narration from our Holy Prophet, peace be upon him, and his family. He has a very special prayer for women practicing hijab. So I found it interesting. Maybe it would be great for practicing hijab women to know that they are included in a special prayer of the Prophet, peace be upon him, and his family. The Holy Prophet says, O Allah, include the women who cover themselves, they practice hijab, with your special mercy and forgiveness. It's a great prayer of
this
the
is
Prophet.
A prayer from the Messenger of Allah
exactly.
to the woman practicing hijab.
Exactly. So as soon as you're wearing hijab, forget about all the other actions, you are covered because the prayer of the Prophet is answered by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala.
Exactly.
You are covered by the mercy and forgiveness of Allah.
This is I gotta ask, in this time of equality, is there no such prayer for men?
As I mentioned previously, covering is for both men and women, but there is no doubt about the fact that covering for women is pretty more difficult. You cannot say that it's the same.
Of course.
So, for example, when during the summer, they also need to cover their head, the hair, and some other parts of the body. And we have a principle in Islam that, in at least most of the cases, the more difficult an act is, the more reward you will receive from Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala. Like fasting, for example, a person who is fasting 10 hours a day, we cannot say that his reward is like the person who is fasting for 20 hours a day. For sure, the latter's reward is much more.
Exactly.
So I believe that this is a very special prayer only for women. Of course, the men are rewarded, but this special prayer is only for women. Now, answering that question, I would like to share a few examples. So, for example, can a person claim that, for example, we are four or five people sitting in a house, in a room, for example, I open a perfume, and for sure the room will be filled by that smell of the perfume. Mm-hmm. Can I ask all the people, all the men, please do not smell the perfume?
No, that's not. For example,
there is a restaurant, and I mean serving different kinds of food. So can I ask my nerves that please do not get hungry by smelling, I mean, the food and so on and so forth? So my point is that imagine for the dear listener who is asking that we do not want to practice hijab, ask the men not to look at us. It's not possible. It's I mean, just like asking the people not to smell that perfume while the room is filled with that perfume. So in a society in which all the people, I mean,
well, the woman is not wearing hijab.
Yeah, if they are not practicing hijab, then we cannot expect all the men not to look. And the reality is telling us the same, that, I mean, in the communities, in the countries in which women are not practicing hijab, they are not wearing proper clothes, now the rate of the crimes related to sexual desires is much more compared to the countries, cities, regions where it is practiced. So even if we claim that women can be free without controlling, without doing hijab, without practicing hijab, can we claim that all the men are infallible, they will not look at non-wearing
hijab?
They
will not harass them?
It's not a reality. I mean, it's not even practical. So when this is the reality, when this is, I mean, practically speaking, this is the case, men, women are attractive, and Allah has created them to be attractive. If they are not going to practice hijab, then they themselves will be bothered, harmed, and harassed by non-practicing men. This is a reality. Nowadays, we are seeing that. Many people are experiencing that in many countries. So this is the last point that I wanted to share. The fact that when women are created by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to be attractive, and they themselves want to be attractive, they cannot expect men to practice, to control themselves and them not practicing hijab. This is not practical.
Thank you very much, Sheikh Murtada. That was very interesting and informative.
Questions and answers on Islamic beliefs on IRIB English Radio. You can send your questions to englishradio@irib.ir.
We have another question. The question is, as a girl, am I allowed to have a boyfriend? If not, how am I supposed to get to know my future husband?
That's a very important question, and it's asked a lot by the, both boys and the girls nowadays, especially those who are practicing Muslims. We are not talking about jurisprudence, because this part of the question is about fiqh and jurisprudence, and they need to consult and ask the marja taqlid that they follow. But generally speaking, the scholars say that such relationships between boys and the girls, even if they have the intention of marriage later, be it through the phone call or, I mean, chit-chatting.